six cases that we will be hearing this morning. Our plan is to take a break after the third case, and we'll go ahead and get started. Our first case this morning is Brown versus Buman, case number 14-4117. Mr. Douglas for the appellant and Mr. Turley for the appellee, and we'll hear from Mr. Douglas.
Excuse me, it took me a second to get my dolls and dishes together. May it please the court, this is Parker Douglas, Utah Federal Solicitor, Office of the Attorney General, on behalf of Mr. Buman. Because the court has raised the issue of mootness, sua sponte, I do have to fulfill my duty of candor to the court and let the court know that a bill file has been opened. And I was informed of this last Friday, that would basically adopt the statutory construction addressed in the opening brief, changing the or between the two prongs of the of the statute to an and. Now, whether that bill gets passed or not, that's up to the legislature. Now, of course, file a 28-J letter.
So this has been filed for legislative consideration.
Yes. And I merely wanted to tell the court it's an open bill file and inform the court that it may receive a subsequent 28-J letter on that issue. I'd like to open by saying that this case has been described as many things by the plaintiffs. Over and over again, they call, citing Obergefell primarily, that this is a case about prejudice or moral and societal bias.
Well, Mr. Douglas, you opened with mootness.
And shall we address
before
that first?
Before we leave that question, could you address why wasn't the district court correct in proceeding to the merits when Mr. Buman filed his second declaration almost 2 years after starting the investigation of the Browns and almost 1 year into the lawsuit?
Why wasn't the district court correct?
Yeah, why wasn't it correct for the district court to go ahead and address the merits?
It wasn't correct for the district court to go ahead and address the merits, primarily for the reasons cited in this court's case of DLS. DLS took place in Utah County. It came up on almost very similar facts. Also had a non-pros letter from the Utah County prosecutor. This court accredited that with mooting the case. We have a similar case.
Well, it's on yes. DLS, before you move on from that, isn't that also the case that they had a U.S. Supreme Court case, excuse me, which is Lawrence v. Texas, and as a sort of a second alternative or factor, the court said, and oh, by the way, if anyone did try to prosecute in the future, you've got Lawrence v. Texas basically saying, yeah, that's not going to work.
Well,
so we don't have anything like that here.
No, we may have the obverse here.
Pardon me?
We may have the obverse here, Your Honor.
The obverse.
And as the as I've cited in my briefs over and over again, we have Potter and Reynolds telling the state that it's okay to criminalize polygamy. Now, there is a distinction here, and that distinction is the non-prosecution letter from Mr. Buman said that it adopted the Utah Attorney General's policy of only prosecuting polygamy in cases that also involved sexual abuse, fraud, and other considerations that often, as the cases cited to this court show, are often part and parcel of the
Mr. Douglas, this came late in the day. What if Mr. Buman had waited until this morning and you walked in the declaration and gave it to us? Would the case be moot then?
No, and I think that's the reason how I addressed, excuse me, Your Honor, how I addressed that in my motion was this. There was an open case file. Very little happened because of the case. It was, and there was debate. I don't know to the extent of that debate was within the Utah County Attorney's Office, but ultimately they decided that they would only prosecute bigamy or polygamy cases in accordance with the policy that the Utah Attorney General has. Now, whether I fully understand the doctrines showing that that defendants who put in a non-pros letter merely to avoid jurisdiction aren't credited by the court. I would suggest that isn't the case here. We haven't had a prosecution of bigamy or polygamy since.
Well, could there even, speaking of, I mean, we're only really looking at the prosecution of these individuals at this point when we're talking about standing and mootness. What is your position about whether now that the Browns have, they filed an affidavit about the same time as Mr. Buman saying they'd moved to Nevada and they had no intent to move back at that point, how could Utah prosecute them now under the Bigamy statute?
I don't believe they could, given the statements of.
And isn't that our issue, is whether they could be prosecuted? They're the folks challenging the statute.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Let me make sure you're answering the question, though. Is the move to Nevada something that prevents prosecution? Not the non-prosecution policy,
yeah,
but the move to Nevada.
Yeah, and I guess my question should have been, is there any way that you can now prosecute them for their conduct in Utah?
I want to answer that question precisely, Your Honor. When you're saying, is there any way I could,
well,
the answer is no. Nevada, and our jurisdiction doesn't extend in Nevada. It's certainly Mr. Buman's jurisdiction doesn't extend outside of Utah.
What about for past conduct? In the state of Utah.
For their past conduct in the state of Utah, I think we have to take both the prior attorney generals and Mr. Buman's prosecutorial declaration.
I still think you're not answering the question. The question is, could the Browns be prosecuted by the Utah County attorney for conduct that occurred in Utah County after they have moved to Nevada?
No. They could not. And they could not because...
I'm leaving the policies aside. The policies aren't there. Well, let's say that there's a murder committed in Utah County. The suspect flees to Nevada. I have to think that person can still be prosecuted in Utah County.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, which is your answer, yes or no? I may be learning some new law here from you that... can you prosecute for the prior conduct of these people in Utah? And forget your policies and everything. If a crime has been committed, and the fact that I may go to another state, are you trying to tell this court that in Utah I still couldn't be charged?
No, I am not saying that, Your Honor.
Well, then what are you saying?
I am saying that given Mr. Buman's declaration, it would be an unconstitutional act to prosecute them now because he has affirmatively said he would not do something.
Okay, forget what he said now.
Okay.
I'm just going to the simple question. Can you still prosecute anyone for a crime that's committed in Utah just because they move out of state means that you can't prosecute them anymore?
No, Your Honor.
All right.
And perhaps I misunderstood the question. I heard, could they be prosecuted in Nevada? That is no. The answer to that is no. Could they be prosecuted?
I think we asked about Utah, but maybe we should.
Could you, before you move on, address the Diaz case? That's the pit bull case in relation to the issue we're discussing. Are you familiar with that case where the owners of the pit bulls had moved out of Denver, and the court said where they had indicated they had no intent to return, that there was no credible threat of prosecution.
If the DS has said they were not returning to Denver, then there is no credible threat of prosecution.
Well, isn't that what the Browns said here?
Well, I don't know if the Browns have said they would come back to Utah or not, and so I don't want to put words in their mouth.
Well, let me ask this question.
But if they have said that, there is no credible threat of prosecution. Excuse me, Judge Baldock.
That's all right. In regards to standing, I think we in the Tenth Circuit have indicated that standing is determined at the time that the charge or complaint is filed in this instance, which would have been in 2011. What injuries were suffered, if any that you know, between the time that these comments were made about not that they could be prosecuted? It seems that the plaintiffs waited almost 11 months after that claim that they, because of their show that there's ample evidence. What else occurred in that 11 months prior to filing them filing their case? What else did? Just the investigation? Is that what's going on only?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's why I said that an open case file in my brief wasn't sufficient for harm purposes under understanding.
Is there a distinction between investigation and actual prosecution?
That, absolutely, Your Honor. There are thousands of case files open for investigation in Utah, and those of you who are former prosecutors can certainly attest to that. We get cases referred to the Utah Attorney General's office by the hundreds every day. There is not a threat of prosecution just merely because a case file exists in our office.
Is that an injury, though?
No, I don't believe it's an injury. In fact, the case cited by counsel, the Susan B. Anthony case, Justice Thomas said, and that was a standing case, that the threatened injury had to be certainly impending or there was a substantial risk that harm would occur. There is neither of those things without an open prosecution. Now, there were statements by Mr. Buhlman saying that he could, and there were statements by two deputy district attorneys said that it would make it easy. But there was no statement of intent to prosecute.
If by chance the panel gets past the question of standing, do you seriously argue still that the second part of the statute that the district judge struck, were using the word or? It seems, I gather from the brief, that you're wanting us to substitute a disjunctive a word for a conjunctive word, which I thought at my level of judgeship is I'm not usually inclined to change a legislator's words in regards to that. So how do you get around Lawrence v. Texas as to the second part of that statute?
Well, Lawrence v. Texas, I think we get around that part of the statute just based on a few things, especially this court's Siegmiller case, stating there's no right to sexual privacy, is a standalone. The other thing I would say is that there's a factual difference between private sexual conduct, even if this court were to find that there was an interest in it, and the public the public character of plural marriage.
Well, when you combine that now with the definition of what our court and its our Supreme Court and its fashionable decisions has decided what marriage is, then when you combine those two cases with the cohabitation, what happens then?
Well, the plaintiffs in this case have said over and over again that this case is not about recognition, and they've said that Obergefell has not.
I know what they've said. I'm asking you.
I would agree with the plaintiffs that Obergefell was about the public recognition of marriage, not the criminalization of polygamy, which this court has recognized as perfectly constitutional. And Hylia, And I would like to say this about Hively, just because I see that I am running out of time. The Hively expressly recognized Reynolds' support for the proposition that adverse impact on religious activity from an operation of a legislative enactment does not translate into impermissible religious targeting where, quote, a social harm may have been a legitimate concern quite apart from discrimination. That is precisely where the district court erred in its application of Hively. I can go on to talk.
Mr. Douglas, I think we're going to have a few more questions for you because we haven't really reached as much the merits yet. And I'd like to ask this. You don't appear to have argued in your brief against the hybrid rights claim. Does that mean that we need to affirm the district court because you've waived that issue?
We did mention hybrid rights. Plaintiffs said that they were left guessing to what our hybrid rights analysis was.
Well, that's why I'm asking. I'm having to guess a little bit too because I didn't see anything in your brief about whether there were colorable claims to free speech, equal protection, establishment clause, and the district court did find a hybrid rights violation as an alternative ground. And you don't even address those arguments in your brief, which leaves us in the position of what do we do with that? It seems like you've waived the issue.
I want to be as candid as possible on this, Your Honor. I inherited this case from lawyers who preceded my working in the Office of the Attorney General, was brought under the prior Attorney General. Those lawyers no longer work in this area. I am left with the record as it was below. I believe that they did waive it. However, Judge...
Well, that really wasn't my question whether it was waived in the district court.
It's waived.
But if you want to say that, that's up
I didn't,
to you.
I didn't think I...
My question is whether you've waived it, because I don't see it in your brief.
I would say that we did argue clearly that Reynolds governs the free exercise claim. The Axe and Flynn case clearly says in note 18 that two questionable constitutional claims do not equal a hybrid rights claim. We've definitely argued against Reynolds or in favor of Reynolds, and we've definitely shown why Lawrence doesn't support.
They're making a claim that there are colorable violations of equal protection, free speech, establishment clause. Now, maybe you disagree with them, maybe you don't, but I don't see you disagreeing with them in your brief, and that's a problem.
It is a problem, Your Honor. I would say that the district court relied only on its analysis of the privacy right in Lawrence and the religious freedom claim in rejecting Reynolds to come to its hybrid rights analysis. That's the best answer I have for you.
All right. One other thing, a little different, but somewhat related, and that is why didn't the state present evidence in district court about the social harms that the state claims that the bigamy statute addresses?
Again, I don't know. I can tell you that those two lawyers have been removed from their positions, largely because of that fact. That's one reason why they didn't. I have talked to them, and what they've informed me of is that because the cases that they cited to the court under Utah law repeatedly recognize the harms associated with
it. I take you appreciate that it isn't our concern, the internal
I understand.
Administration of your office.
I understand.
We have to work from the record that was made in district court, and where's and what you're telling me is that there wasn't evidence presented.
There was not evidence presented, but there were legal citations to law where it was recognized as a matter of law that there are harms associated with polygamous practices. The Kitchen case, which I helped litigate last year, presented to this court social studies and allowed the introduction of citation of those social studies to address harm. I've cited that in my reply brief. The 10th Circuit clearly allowed that to go forward, and I've cited studies that talk about harm in my brief. So that's my answer, is they may not have presented it below, but for citations to case law. But Kitchen expressly allows that to be social studies and other information to be introduced and cited to the Court of Appeals when there is a question about a balancing under either a rational basis or strict scrutiny analysis. And I've done that just as we did in the Kitchen case.
I have a question on the due process claim. And assuming a rational basis test, and it's kind of a general question, but how do we talk about the various legitimate state interests that you've alleged that the state has, and there's several you've alleged, when the state has chosen not to prosecute at all, basically, under this bigamy statute, and I don't see how you get to have your cake and eat it, too, on that.
Well,
you have a legitimate state interest, but you've declined to take action on that.
I would disagree with Your Honor to a certain extent. I think that the Holm, the Green, and there's another case the Kingston case, excuse me. I'm forgetting a very famous family. All addressed those harms, and they all prosecuted on those harms. And it would still be the...
My point is, you're not prosecuting, and we have various statements, apparently, from various county prosecutors saying, yeah, we're not going to prosecute unless there's something in addition to what the statute declares unlawful. And yet you're standing here and you tell us we have these legitimate state interests, but, oh, by the way, we're not going to prosecute. Doesn't that sort of negate those alleged state interests?
No, it does not. And I would again point to the DLS case as a statement from this court that shows, and that was a very little prosecuted statute. It was also, as you pointed out, questionable because of Lawrence. But in the DLS case, and I'm looking at 374 F3rd at 975, it says, the fact that the city brought charges in the context of a rape investigation for conduct involving a minor does not support an inference that DLS faces real and imminent threat of prosecution, especially where we have an affidavit from the prosecutor. That answers your first question. But on the same page, the court recognizes that criminal provisions may have a primary prosecutorial purpose of providing additional evidence on related charges, where it's, in quote, it says, the sodomy charge was brought because of the statements made by the girl about her oral sex with the defendant over a 24-hour period.
Well, that's fine and good, but that's not what you're telling us your legitimate state interests are.
That would be one legitimate state interest, that if we are prosecuting them along with fraud and child sex abuse cases, we also get the benefit of having evidence come in that is very useful. This is a common charging practice by both federal and state prosecutors who come into this court, and it's recognized in a 10th Circuit decision. Now, I'm not saying that Utah has a standalone interest in the polygamy or bigamy statute simply because of that, but it definitely has that interest. Along with that, it has the ancillary differences that have been recognized in case law for over 100 years.
What? In a nutshell, we've read the briefs and we've listened to the argument. if you had one important thought that you wanted to leave with this court as to why you what's your best argument as to why we should overturn what the district court did below, what's your best foot for? What's your best argument? What you're going to rely on that's the best?
It's what I addressed squarely in my reply brief, Your Honor. This court, or this panel, is bound by Potter. The district court was bound by Potter. The district court and this court are bound by Reynolds. That case is not overturned. Is in the section I just read from Hylia, Hylia itself recognized that Reynolds was still vital, and vital for the reason that this statute is operationally neutral and facially neutral. And Hylia says specifically that if it has ancillary effects, but those ancillary effects are to address real social harm, then it violates the First Amendment not at all.
Thank you.
So I answered it in two ways. I'm sorry, Judge Baldwin.
Mr. Douglas, we've gone a fair amount over, and I think we should now hear from Mr. Turley.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll also be giving you extra time so that Your Honor. Equal playing field.
Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Jonathan Turley, and I represent the Brown family in this action. I'd like to just go directly to some of the questions raised by the panel. First of all, dealing with standing and mootness, we start with the proposition which has already been referenced by the panel and is contained in cases like MedImmune in the Supreme Court, that ripeness and standing, what the court says, quote, boil down to the same question in pre-enforcement cases. And so if you take a look at Friends of the Earth, you look at that at the time of the filing. And to address the question of harm, the district court found that we had stated injuries. Those were then accompanied by later affidavits referring to the time of filing. And the court made findings of fact as to the injuries. But I'd like to focus on a couple of standards where we depart from my esteemed colleague.
Could I just ask you to clarify one thing, though? While standing is determined at the time of filing, a case can become moot after it has been filed. And I think a number of our questions to Mr. Douglas actually went to the mootness point.
And, yes, Your Honor, I would let me go to mootness, then I'll come back. We have time to standing.
Sure.
The mootness question, first and foremost, I think it's incumbent for me to say that I do not believe that mootness is appropriately before the court for one reason. And this is an area which I admit is somewhat undefined on this issue. Usually when the government makes standing and mootness claims, they, of course, vigorously assert them on the Court of Appeals. Standing and mootness are a little different in that sense, in that standing is always obviously ready for the court to look at, to reexamine as it should. Mootness, the Supreme Court has said, has a heavy, astringent burden upon the defendant. The defendant has to satisfy those conditions, which I'll get to in a second. When a defendant abandons the issue, when the defendant basically says, I'm not going to argue to you that this is moot, I don't see how they can possibly shoulder that burden. And I don't believe that telling a defendant, well, now make that argument again, he's abandoned not just the argument, he's abandoned his burden in showing that to the Court of Appeals. I've never seen a case where it has been retroactive, but I'm willing to accept that.
Well, but doesn't that suggest that a litigant can waive a jurisdictional issue? And, of course, a litigant can't do that. You're still going to the question of whether they've satisfied their burden, aren't you?
I am, because the court's made clear that they have this heavy burden, and when they no longer argue those facts to the court, when they no longer assert that this is moot for those reasons.
But counsel, it is our responsibility to determine whether we have jurisdiction.
Yes, I agree, Your Honor.
And so here's my question then. If Mr. Buman's second declaration, the one that was filed after the suit had been going for a while, if it's genuine, if the declaration is genuine, that he has no intention to charge the Browns, does it matter that he may have been motivated, at least in part, in wanting to end the case?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that this court and the Supreme Court has said that. That is, they have, if you look at the cases and the authority cited by the defendant, they actually contradict what he's saying here. If I could look at those elements, you brought up correctly, obviously, the Winness case, which is also built on Mink and is also built on Friends. All of those cases refer to this heavy burden. On the three factors that the courts laid out, the defendant clearly violates two of them and barely satisfies one.
Can I interrupt you there?
Of course, Your Honor.
I have a concern the way you refer to them as three factors in your brief and now here today, because I don't think the court has ever said these are the three factors. In the Winness case, it said here's three reasons why we're going to find that what, you know, they came to their conclusion based on these three facts, essentially, in that case. But I didn't read our case law to say these are the only three facts that we're going to look at. And what they were looking at is what's the credible threat of prosecution? Isn't that the overarching theory behind whatever facts we look at?
Of course, you are correct that it's the overarching theory. What I would submit is that if you look at Winness, Mink, and Friends, these elements appear in those cases, and they're an obvious touchstone in terms of mootness. They've been cited by various courts. And if you look at those factors, you can see how far out this is as an outlier. First of all, the courts made reference to the quick repudiation. As the court mentioned, this occurred 2 years after the event, 10 months, during which the district court repeatedly asked the defendant, do you have a policy? He admitted later, no, he didn't have a policy, adopted it for this case. It came 10 months later, and the district court repeatedly pressed them on this.
Didn't just adopt it for this case, did he?
No, he said he did adopt it for this case.
But I mean, during this case, but he's applying it to other cases. I mean, this is his policy, just as other counties now have policies. I think his affidavit said that he hadn't had any reason, essentially, because he hadn't opened any files or he hadn't thought about prosecuting. This was new to him. I mean, there's reasons why he didn't have a policy, essentially.
I would respectfully disagree with that, because in many ways the defendant has doubled down on appeal and says that this law is not only constitutional and enforceable, but both on the district court level and references in the briefs on appeal, they say this is a very important law for us because it allows us to conduct investigations, searches, and seizures of plural families when we don't have sufficient evidence of these other crimes. And that's why we want it. And the defendant has said that he values it for that purpose. But if you take a look at Mink and in Winsness, the repudiation occurred before the case was filed. And in Mink, it occurred almost immediately after the charge was filed.
But the counsel, I'm kind of stuck. The trial court just merely drops a footnote saying the difference in the time was of no moment. In other words, the fact that 11 months passed before you filed your complaint in regards to this, going to what the credibility of enforcement issue, that's why I asked the question about an investigation versus prosecution. The court, while legitimately saying, where are you here, it can't interfere with a legitimate investigation and then all of a sudden just say, well, that's an injury, can't he?
Well, Your Honor, what I would submit is that we've made both an as-applied and facial challenge to the statute. And in this case, we cite cases like Gonzalez by the Tenth Circuit saying that the standard is, quote, more relaxed when you have a First Amendment or a free speech case. And we've cited both in the complaint and in affidavits the damages, both economic and professional, but also the status. What the defendant is suggesting is that the state can criminalize a group of people and not just do that, but then use that law to publicly say you are felons. I mean, to say that they have proven they are felons, this family, you, the Browns.
Then why not file a suit immediately?
Well, actually, part of it was that we were dealing with the state to determine, you know, whether they were going to drop this.
Doesn't matter who you're dealing with. Once your client felt that they were in that type, then why wait 11 months? Why not say what you're doing is unconstitutional right now and violates my rights.
Because we were preparing for this case. We were trying to establish exactly the basis for the filing, to file a good faith complaint, to line up what affidavits that we would have to show harm. And we did so. But what I would submit, Your Honor, is that not only does Gonzalez say that you have to look at the free speech and First Amendment issues, if you take a look at Dryhouse by the Supreme Court, that's 134 Supreme Court 2334, that's the last one of these ripeness standing cases. That was 2014. In that case, the underlying complaint had been dropped. There was no underlying complaint, and the Supreme Court reversed the Sixth Circuit. Because the Sixth Circuit said, well, you know what, the complaint's been dismissed, so we don't know if you're going to violate the statute. We don't know if they're going to enforce it. And the Supreme Court said, you're wrong. And the Supreme Court said, what is important here is that they have shown, quote, an intention to engage in a course of conduct arguably affected with the constitutional interest and prescribed by a statute. The same is true with Doe v. Bolton. That statute wasn't enforced at all.
Can we go back to the facts that we look at? Because
of course.
It all comes back to this whole overarching principle of you've got to show a certainty, not a certainty of prosecution, but essentially some credible threat of prosecution. And it can't just be some potential threat. And the district court didn't factor in the fact that your clients have moved to Nevada and the affidavit that said, we've moved to Nevada. And I read the affidavit of Mr. Brown as trying to focus on everything but a credible threat of prosecution and saying, well, we're still sustaining injuries because, and he lists various things, but there's nothing at all about any intent to move back or any real credible threat of prosecution. And I'd like for you to address that because the district court didn't.
Of course. Your Honor, the declarations actually do contain, and I could certainly give those citations to the court, the declarations do contain, and we did argue from the district court, that the Browns want to return to the state of Utah.
Well, I'm talking about the most, I think it was the latest affidavit.
We have six affidavits, Your Honor, and the declarations, and in fact our filings with the trial court, state repeatedly that they want to return to Utah.
Right. But even assuming, let's assume the most recent affidavit says they want to return to Utah at some indefinite time in the future. How does that fit within the case law requiring that there be some certainty of prosecution, just some thought that, yeah, we might like to come back? How does that fit?
What I would submit, Your Honor, is that, first of all, going back to Gonzalez in those cases, in free speech cases, you have to look at the effect of the chilling effect upon the exercise of the right involved. The district court here made a finding.
Don't get to that chilling effect unless there's a credible threat of prosecution.
But in Gonzalez, Your Honor, this court said that when you're in the presence of those types of values, it has a more relaxed standard because of the chilling effect. And if you look at American Booksellers by the Supreme Court, there was no prosecution, no enforcement, but the court said it's enough that the law targets this group of people because the court said it produces self-censorship. Those declarations from the Browns talk about how actually Utah is where their religious group is centered.
Yeah. But what about the Pitbull case? How do you get past that?
I think there's a big difference with DS in this case. In DS, you had a Pitbull operation that was moved to Denver, and there was a statement that if you move the operation, then we no longer have jurisdiction. There's a difference between free speech cases. You know, these are people who are engaging in free speech. The court made a finding that they left Utah, curtailed their free speech activities. They're on national television, and I'm surprised by the passing suggestion.
But again, it comes down to the prosecution, the threat of prosecution, and that was the point of that case, is they can't be prosecuted. They're no longer in the state. The pit bulls aren't in the state, and that's the point, isn't it?
Yeah. What I would submit.
They moved out of Denver, where they had the ordinance.
What I would submit is that their free speech is in the state in the sense that they're engaged in a national program. Their religious sect, which they have to visit, is in Utah. They've stated that they want to go back to Utah. That's where their religious group is focused. That's where they came from. In the appellate briefs, the defendant doubles down and says, again, they are guilty I mean, in the appellate brief, they said, you know, we wouldn't even have to present witnesses. They are felons. What I would suggest is that these other cases don't involve aspects of this one. You don't have a single family being singled out publicly and saying, you guys are felons under this law. The defendant down in district court said that officials had used, quote, this law endlessly to accuse plural families of being criminals. And it takes an act of willful blindness to suggest that if your family is declared a criminal enterprise and you're specifically called a felon, not just before, but they continue to do it, that that's no cognizable harm. I mean, that's the type of harm that you, it's hard to imagine if it's never happened to you. And what the state is suggesting is that it can criminalize groups. It can create a statute that allows easier searches and seizures that don't apply to non-plural families. It can...
Counsel, let me ask you this question. Have they ever stopped their national... I've never seen it. Their program that they televised, have they ever stopped or ceased doing that?
No, what they stopped is they stopped public statements in the state of Utah, and there's a finding of the district court.
Well, no, but my question is, we keep talking about injury. Have they ever stopped with their violation of their free speeches? Have they ever stopped the public television program that they have at any time during all of those proceedings?
No, Your Honor, but that's only one of the injuries. They've also spoken publicly, and they have said that they have stopped making those appearances in Utah.
Well, maybe in Utah, but I'm trying to look going backwards and going forwards in this when you look at standing and mootness and things like this. We keep talking about injury. Well, somebody may have been injured, but definitely these people haven't been injured because it's never curtailed their programming habit or curtailed their holding themselves out to be what they are.
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor, on a couple of points.
All right.
One is, I think there is an injury when you can no longer engage in speech in an entire state where they are born and their religious organization is centered. They meet in Utah County. That is the focus of their religious center. The district court found that they have left the state in fear of prosecution, and they have curtailed that free speech. I also believe that it is an injury when you trip this wire, when you use the law to publicly say that family, the Browns, are felons. That has an impact on a family that I don't think the court can ignore. They do. They are public figures. They have promotional contracts. We put in two declarations from managers saying, of course, if you have the government saying those people are committing crimes every night, it has a huge impact on their ability to contract.
The problem is that you're challenging this criminal statute. And to challenge criminal statute pre-enforcement, you have to have a credible threat of prosecution.
Your Honor, what I would submit, if you look at the cases like American Booksellers, you look at Dry House, that is not the standard that you see in those cases. More importantly, if you look at the third element out of Witness, and Your Honor brought this up, that in Witness and in Mink, they couldn't prosecute because of the Lawrence case. And what's also I point out is that they cite more federal practices or other authority. If you actually look at it, it says the opposite. Section 101.99, they say in Moore that a defendant's continued assertion of a right to engage in the alleged wrongful conduct, which is what they're doing, despite having ceased to do so, will generally preclude a finding of mootness.
But isn't, again, even in Winsness, and I think I'm hearing that you're agreeing that Winsness didn't set a three-part test. Those were three considerations that court looked at. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would say that it's considered. I would disagree that these were passing considerations. They appear in various cases, and they're obviously the touchstones used by this court.
All right, but also on Winsness, hadn't the prosecutor in that case actually at least taken initial steps to do the prosecution? There was Larson, there was Winsness, the prosecutor, Mr. Blaylock. Wasn't there a prosecution commenced against Winsness?
There was some steps taken, but that's not present in the other cases that we've cited.
It's not present here either.
Well, no, but I'm saying that there are plenty of cases which we've cited by the Supreme Court of the United States.
All right. I'm just asking you about Winsness right now, but that's fine.
Yeah, my understanding is that there were some steps taken. Yes.
All right. You claim throughout your briefs that this statute is enforced only against religious polygamists. What evidence in the record supports that claim?
Well, first of all, the district court has a finding to that effect, that the statute
we're on summary judgment, right? This isn't a finding of fact after trial. We're on summary judgment. We have to take the record as it was presented to the district court. And so that's why I'm asking you the question. What does the record show about the pattern of prosecution? You keep saying that it's only against religious polygamists. I'm interested in how the record supports that.
The reason I was citing was not necessarily that the finding was binding in that respect.
I understand, but I'm asking not about what the district court said. I'm asking you what the district court might have based that on.
Right. There have, in fact, been prosecutions, but we know in our brief that they are rare. But the rest of the record shows that both in the trial court and before this court, the defendants are not treating this as moribund statute. They're saying this statute is needed. We use it.
Now, this isn't the question. Your claim is that all the prosecutions are religiously based. What I want to know is, does the record really support that?
It does.
How does it support it? They go out and they get 10 cases from the court administrator's office, and I'm just not seeing the pattern there, and it's not really a big database to begin with. So maybe you're correct, maybe you're not, but how does the record support that claim?
In our brief, we cite statements from defense counsel below in which the defense counsel makes clear that this law has been used for religious polygamists, for religious plural families.
Exclusively?
Yeah, he talks about how this law...
What about the Gear case? That wasn't based on religion. And that's a reported case.
Right. The record in this case, it is true that this statute sometimes can be used in terms of actual bigamy, multiple marriage license type of cases.
I'm just curious whether either one of you could list out a handful of documented cases, and they're all religiously based prosecutions. And I'd like to know where that is in the record.
I'd be happy to submit that to the panel on the record, which I can do through the clerk, but I would also like to submit the admissions by the defendant. The defendant didn't challenge this. The defendant didn't argue this. They're not suggesting it. In fact, even before this court, they're saying...
Isn't this a critical fact in determining whether this statute is operationally neutral and generally applicable?
Okay. I would answer that in two parts. First of all, I don't think this court can ignore the statements of the defendant as to their agreement with us as to who's been focused on this, on the statute.
Is this the colloquy that occurred before the district court between the judge...
Waddups.
Judge Waddups. And who was it from the state? It was...
The predecessor, yes.
Okay. It was that colloquy that you're talking about, right?
It's not just that. They also state in their briefs that the reason they want this law is specifically because of religious plural families. They repeatedly state that these families are more insular and that they use this law when they don't have evidence of other crimes so that they can go in. The defendant has not challenged this point, and I don't think that it can be ignored.
Well, maybe... But it'd be nice to have some evidence of them only using this in a religious to do this in a religiously targeted way. And like I said, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But where's the evidence in the record?
Now, one thing that we may be speaking in cross purposes on is when we talk about the use of the statute, that we have argued that it is not just the prosecution, that they've used the statute, obviously, to publicly condemn this family as felons, but also that this statute is embraced, even before this court, by the defendant and saying, we use this because we often don't have evidence to go in after religious polygamists. Now, in Hialeah, you had a statute which was completely written neutrally. And the court rejected that argument and said, basically, give me a break. And so did the district court here. The district court looked specifically at the...
Counsel, there are parts of Hialeah that analyze the wording of the statute in trying to determine whether it is neutral as enforced. But I guess my question here is, what would the state do if it encounters a situation, a cohabitation situation, the participants in that situation are not doing it for religious reasons? Is the state always going to look the other way? And is that in the record somewhere?
Yes. The district court specifically had not one but two colloquies with the defendant specifically on this point of what do you do with adulterers under the statute? What do you do with other people cohabitating? And the state said, oh, no, we don't. This is not part of the dimension for us. This is not about them. And so you have repeated statements from the defendant saying, look, these people are compound, secluded individuals. These are religious polygamists who hide from society. That's why we need this law. And there's, I think, ample evidence to support that. What I would also support...
And when you say ample evidence, you mean statements of counsel yes. on the record.
Well, I would think that admissions would be binding on the state in defending the statute. I'll also note that the reliance on... We've cited all these Supreme Court cases where there's zero enforcement. Some of these cases occurred right after the enactment of laws, and the Supreme Court reversed Court of Appeals and said, you are ignoring the free speech and First Amendment injuries, the chilling effect of these types of laws. And if you instead, they put forward DLS and Bronson, and I would submit that those cases are clearly in opposite. First of all, they occurred before Dry House, but more importantly, in DLS, the prosecution was for the act of sodomy. It was someone who was challenging the statute because they wanted to engage in private conduct. They didn't criminalize the status of this family. And as the court noted, Lawrence was cited by saying, you can't enforce. I mean, you have no threat of prosecution because you can't enforce this law. Bronson involved the marriage licenses, and the reason that was tossed out is that this court found that they had failed to make proper arguments in front of the Court of Appeals, and that effectively waived or negated their claims to challenge the statute, and also said the person you're suing can't even give you what you want. But in Bronson, it said the clarity is at the polls in these types of cases. The court said it's often difficult to look at pre-enforcement cases. But the clearest poll, they said, the credible threat, was when you have someone unlike Bronson who has the authority to enforce the law. And what I would submit is that if the standard is that you need a charge, then all these pre-enforcement cases the Supreme Court has handed down are negated. That is, the court was out of its mind to rule on those cases. And instead, the court has reversed a series of court of appeals that have said it's too speculative. We don't know if you're going to violate this law. I would submit to you that this is a much stronger case.
Mr. Turley, can I just ask? We're eating up some time here, and we're going to have to get to our other cases. But to what extent is this court and the district court bound by the Utah Supreme Court's interpretation of the statute in Holm and Green?
It was interesting when in the reply brief the defendant said, you know, we actually didn't mean it was binding precedent. And that is, in fact, correct in the sense that you're not bound by the interpretations of the constitutional rulings.
No, I'm talking about interpretation of the statute.
If
the Supreme Court of the state of Utah says this statute means the following, don't we have to accept that?
Yes, and what it says is the opposite of what the defendant said. The Utah Supreme Court said that their interpretation of this statute is not true. That is, the Supreme Court of Utah said that it is not, as they tried to replace that or with an and.
No, I'm not talking about or and and. I'm talking about purport to marry, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have the district court in this case saying it's axiomatic that we must follow the interpretation of the statute by the Utah Supreme Court. But then later on in the opinion, it interprets the purport to marry in a narrower way than the Utah Supreme Court did in Holm. And my question is, how can a federal court do that?
I think it can do it in the sense that what the court was doing was applying the constitutional principles to minimize the impact on the statute and to apply the controlling cases. This is a sort of hybrid situation.
Well, no, I understand that, but that's the question, really. Under what authority can a federal court adopt a narrower view of the statute than the state Supreme Court has adopted to advance a constitutional avoidance position? I mean, I'm interested in if you've got any.
No, I see your point.
It's an interesting
question. No, as a law professor, I love the question. It might be next year's exam question.
I can tell you that if you say that they can do that, we've just learned some new constitutional law. that he's rewritten. He says, to save this statute, I'm going to, in my individual knowledge, rewrite the Supreme Court of Utah's holding. And he can't do that. I can answer that question.
I will yield to you on that point. I actually think it is actually a closer question in one respect in terms of Judge Wadoff's, and that is there is, of course, a line of cases trying to narrow the impact of these decisions. And these district court judges are admonished continually not to have more expansive rulings. And I think that what he was trying to do is, in that line of cases, and in light of the new Supreme Court precedent that we have, is to save as much of the statute as possible. And I'll note, by the way, that he drew a line that is ignored by the defendant. When the defendant says Reynolds is still good law and that we're saying it's not, we're not saying that. What we're saying is that it's not the precedent that the defendant thinks it is. Reynolds was focused on actual bigamy, having multiple marriage licenses. And if you look at some of these cases, they are also talking about actual bigamy. And on actual bigamy, Reynolds probably can still be cited. And if you look at our brief, if you look at the cases where it's cited, it seems to reflect that in many cases.
Mr. Turley, I think we'd better call it a day. We appreciate your argument, and I think we actually owe Mr. Douglas a few minutes, 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Your Honors, I'll be briefer than 4 minutes. The colloquy that Mr. Turley talks about is...
It's Mr. Jensen, I'm now remembering, right? The colloquy.
It is Jensen. Mr. Jensen.
Right.
If you actually look at it, it's on page 8 of Plaintiff Appellee's brief. You asked the question, has this been applied in other areas to non-religious people? You cited the Gear case. That is certainly one of them. When we have the colloquy that Mr. Turley just described with Mr. Jensen, the Judge Wadoff is asking him essentially the same question or a similar question, and he's trying to distinguish it from adultery. And he says, so tell me, what's the difference between adultery and what you've just described? And what Mr. Jensen had just described is, in practice, there is a marriage. It may not be recognized by the state, but it's a marriage. It's performed. There's a wedding. There are vows. The problem is proving it. The court says, so what's the difference between adultery and that? The one is that they claim to be married, but just because the state can't prove it doesn't mean it hasn't happened. That's what's happening in the polygamous communities. Now, if you look at the brief, Mr. Turley has incited in brackets, religious. That is not what Mr. Jensen said to the district court.
Well,
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Judge Wadoff says, so it's the expression of the fact that the purpose a person is a wife that makes it illegal. Mr. Jensen answers yes. There is no description of targeting religious folks.
Well, we'll take a further look at the colloquy. But a question I've got for you is, however the proper reading of it is the state bound by Mr. Jensen's answers to the court's questions?
Before this panel, but not for prior polygamy or bigamy prosecutions.
All right. Can I just ask you, the district court uses this term a lot in its opinion, religious cohabitation, which isn't in the statute, but gets used throughout the opinion. What's the genesis of that term?
Your guess is as good as mine, Your Honor. I think it happened over the course of the case where they were trying to describe what polygamy or bigamy was. Now, it's a historic fact in Utah that many religious folks do cohabitate for religious reasons. Many cohabitate and say they're married for non-religious reasons. The statute is silent on treating those folks differently.
Well, are we, if we're trying to get a better understanding of the statute, do we get to legislative history? Well, let me ask you this. If we get to legislative history, do we go back to 1892?
I would look at legislative history, but I would also look at prosecutorial.
Well, do we go back to 1892 if we're looking at legislative history? Do we have to look at territorial law? Well, for that matter, do we go back to 1862? What is the relevant universe of legislative history, if we get to it, that we should be looking at?
I think that the statute's clear on its face.
I understand that.
But to answer the question directly, there is a reason that the statute's on the books, and that is because of the irrevocable ordinance requirement for Utah statehood. I can't ignore that. And I would be disingenuous with this court if I did. That does not mean that the statute in practice is intended to target only religious people. And if I may have...
Why don't you finish up and we'll call it the day for you two.
Thank you, Your Honor. The only other thing that I would cite, I would ask the court to look at the district court's order of February 3rd, 2012. It's at the appendix, volume 2, at 264, 265. There, the district court rejected the idea of a chilling effect with regard to reputational injury, and this is a quote. This case differs in the plaintiff's, quote, other consequences. It was talking about types of harms, other consequences being one of them, e.g., reputation, money, damages, lost jobs, do not extend from the simple existence of the anti-bigamy statute. It likewise follows that an injury stemming from a threat of enforcement is only cognizable if the threat of enforcement is itself.
Thank you, Mr. Douglas. We appreciate your arguments, and I noticed a raised hand. I guess if can you give us a 10-second?
Yeah, the distinction was because in our complaint, we challenged cohabitation, both religious and non-religious, so the court separated out its analysis, particularly in looking at what standard would apply, Your Honor. So the court, in the opinion, talks about what standard would apply for those affected by non-religious cohabitation and what standard apply by religious cohabitation because different cases would apply to those claims.
So it came from the court?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Okay, thanks again to both of you. We appreciate your arguments. The case will be submitted, and counsel are excused.